Hello, Sun Sounds listeners. This is Michael Shannon, your volunteer reader. I'm going to read the major news articles from the Monday, December 29th, 2025 edition of Tucson's Arizona Daily Star. And before we begin with the headline articles, let's find out what kind of weather is in store for us today. Today's weather: cloudy skies, highs to near 70 degrees Fahrenheit, winds east-southeast at 10 to 20 miles per hour. Tonight's weather: partly cloudy skies, lows to 52 degrees Fahrenheit, winds east-southeast at 10 to 20 miles per hour. Tomorrow's forecast predicts partly cloudy skies, highs to 73 degrees Fahrenheit, winds east-southeast at 15 to 25 miles per hour. Now from the Arizona Daily Star front page, the first article is titled, "Disability Rights Lawyers Face Budget Cuts." This article was written by Tony Lays of KFF Health News. The Trump administration is trying to slash access to lawyers who defend the rights of Americans with disabilities, advocates say. Most of the lawyers work either for the Department of Justice or for disability rights agencies that Congress set up in every state decades ago. Many of the Justice Department lawyers quit in 2025 after being reassigned to other duties, their supporters say. And Trump budget officials propose deep cuts to federal grants supporting the state-based legal groups. Federal laws and court decisions say people with disabilities may attend schools, work jobs, and go to restaurants, movie theaters, and other public places, and they can file legal challenges when those rights are denied. The federally funded attorneys quietly work to ensure that the U.S. lives up to the promises made by the Americans with Disabilities Act and other laws, said Allison Barkoff, a health law professor at George Washington University. The attorney's goals include ensuring that people with disabilities have the services they need to live in their homes instead of having to move into nursing homes or other types of institutions, Barkoff said. The state-based disability rights groups are known as protection and advocacy organizations. Most of them are nonprofit groups. Congress approved the federally financed system in the 1970s. But President Donald Trump proposed cutting the system's federal funding from $148 million to $69 million for fiscal year 2026, according to the National Disabilities Rights Network, which represents the state-based groups. White House officials declined to comment on why the Trump administration proposed the deep cuts. Isaac Schreier's family can attest to the value of the state-based legal groups. Isaac Seven lives in Ankeny, Iowa. He has a rare condition called osteogenesis imperfecta, also known as brittle bone disease. The condition has caused about 60 bone fractures, including in his limbs, spine, and skull. It can cause intense pain and leave him unable to walk. At times, Isaac's disability is practically invisible, said his father, Jake Schreier. Unless he has recently severed a broken leg bone, he walks well. Isaac's doctor said he needed a special wheelchair that can be adjusted to put him in different positions depending on which bones were broken. But the private insurer that manages his Medicaid coverage declined to pay for the $3,500 wheelchair. They required proof that it was a permanent and long-standing condition, Schreier said. We were very frustrated. Schreier appealed to denial but lost. A nurse then recommended he reach out to Disability Rights Iowa, a federally funded protection and advocacy group. The group linked Schreier with two of its attorneys who filed a new appeal. The doctors wrote a detailed letter explaining why Isaac was legally entitled to the new wheelchair, and they cited specific Iowa codes and court precedents. The insurer wound up paying for Isaac's special wheelchair. David Hutt, Deputy Executive Director for Legal Services at the National Disability Rights Network, noted that state-based advocacy groups have legal authority to go into state institutions and privately owned nursing homes where people with disabilities live to check conditions and treatment. More Americans could wind up living in such settings if Trump succeeds in his quest to institutionalize people with mental illness who are living in the streets, Hutt said. At the same time, states are facing cuts in federal contributions to Medicaid. In response, they may be tempted to reduce Medicaid coverage of community care programs, many of which are considered optional under federal law, Hutt said. If that happens, you're going to get increased institutionalization, which actually costs more, he said. Disability rights organizations often have stepped in when states fail to provide care and services that people with disabilities are entitled to. So have lawyers from the Justice Department Civil Rights Division. But since Trump returned to office, many of the Justice Department's most experienced disability rights lawyers have taken out buyouts or been reassigned to other areas, said Jennifer Mathis, a former top administrator at the Justice Department under Biden. The overall Civil Rights Division is down to about 300 people, fewer than half the number it had under Biden, Mathis said. The Civil Rights Division's new director, Harmeet Dhillon, told conservative commentator Glenn Beck in April that more than 100 attorneys had left the division, but that they didn't support Trump's priorities. In a statement to KFF Health News, Dhillon said the division continues to be a vocal and active advocate for Americans with disabilities. Dhillon noted the department recently sued Uber over complaints that the ride-hailing service was turning away customers with service dogs or wheelchairs, has secured agreements with Arkansas and North Carolina to improve treatment of imprisoned people with disabilities, and is investigating large bus companies over allegations of failing to provide proper accommodations for people with disabilities. The next front page article is titled Renewed Push to Honor Bowles. This article was written by Howard Fisher of Capital Media Services. Dateline Phoenix. It will be 50 years this coming June since Arizona Republic reporter Don Bowles was killed in a car bombing linked to an investigation he was doing. And Representative Selena Bliss says she thinks the timing may finally be right to line up the votes and overcome some opposition from a few within her own Republican Party to allow a memorial to him to be placed across the street from the Capitol in West Boland Plaza. It isn't a question of money. HB 2079, sponsored by the Prescott lawmaker, says any funds for its constructions have to be privately raised. And that's been the financial case now for the entire time since the idea was first proposed in 2023 by Phoenix Democratic Representative Jennifer Longden and Republican Senator T.J. Shoup from Coolidge. Prior efforts have run up against Senator Jake Hoffman, the Queen Creek Republican who chairs the Senate Judiciary Committee. Though Hoffman has never explained his position, he has used his position to block memorial plans. The Senate President Warren Peterson has chosen in the past not to exercise his ability to have the proposal sidestep Hoffman's committee. Bliss, a Prescott Republican, picked up the cause after Longden left the legislature. She said she thinks maybe this is the year, particularly since prior efforts by her and others have produced more than enough bipartisan support to get the necessary votes. I spoke with his daughter, she told Capital Media Services, referring to Diane. She is stepping up to support the effort with an eye on the 50th anniversary. This is it, Bliss said. Her original bill cleared the House on a 45-15 bipartisan margin, only to be assigned by Peterson to Hoffman's committee, where it died. So she cooked up a plan. Bliss got permission from Senator Janet Shump, Republican of Surprise, to tack the exact time, or rather the exact same language, onto an unrelated bill that had already passed the Senate when it went to the House. Again, a 45-11 approval. That sent the now amended bill back to the Senate, where Peterson could simply have brought the new version up for a final vote on the full chamber without further committee action. It did not, and the bill died. Senate leadership failed to move it forward, Bliss said, and this year, I wonder if Senate President Peterson can assign it to a different committee to give it a chance, Bliss asked. Peterson did not respond to multiple inquiries asking whether he will again assign any House-passed bill to Hoffman's committee. where it would again meet the same fate, nor would he say whether he would use his power to get around Hoffman. Still, some things are different this year. Peterson, now running for state attorney general, is looking at a larger constituency than just his home community. And there's something else. The Senate president is pushing his own plan to create an honor for someone else who was struck down. He wants to rename a 78-mile freeway that loops in and around Phoenix for Charlie Kirk, killed in a shooting earlier this year in Utah, as memorial. It is right that Arizonans are regularly reminded of the tremendous legacy of this champion for free speech who was assassinated for his stand, which is why I introduced this bill, Peterson explained earlier this month. Bliss took note. When I saw Charlie Kirk proposal, I thought, well, this is perfect because a precedent will be set that Senator Warren Peterson is going to run an individual out there that's part of our history, she said. So this makes the Don Bolts bill even more applicable to his movement to acknowledge these individuals and their important part of history. That history is why Bliss, who grew up in Arizona, said, drives her on this issue. I think I was 13 when this happened, she said. It very much affected me to think that this could happen in the United States of America, someone being assassinated with a car bomb for discovering the truth. Bowles had gone to the Clarendon Hotel in Midtown, Phoenix in 1976 to meet with a source. That person, later identified as John Harvey Adamson, never showed up. As he was backing out six sticks of dynamite, which had been attached to his 1976 Datsun 210, were detonated by remote control. He died 11 days later. Adamson, seeking to avoid the death penalty, agreed to testify against Max Dunlop, saying he had ordered Bolts to be killed, with police saying that was because of a story the reporter had written about a friend, liquor magnate Kemper Marley. Dunlop eventually was sentenced to life behind bars after a first conviction was overturned. He died in prison after a clemency plea was rejected. Adamson and James Robeson, who was accused of actually planting and detonating the bomb, also have since died. Bliss said it's important for people to be told that story. We have so many people that come to Arizona and they do not understand our important, rich history, Bliss said. And this is very much a part of it. Now, the question for lawmakers is whether Bowles deserves to be honored in Wesley Bowles Plaza in the same way that Arizona honors various veterans, pioneer women, the Ten Commandments, and Jesuit missionary Father Kino. The plaza already is home to more than 24 plaques, statues, and other memorabilia, including large guns from the USS Arizona and USS Missouri. State law requires that any memorial, regardless of whether, as is in this case, the tab is to be picked up through private donations, must get legislative approval and the signature of the governor. The idea has had its detractors. One was Representative Jacqueline Parker, who was a Mesa Republican representative in 2023. So the only thing this guy accomplished is that he was a reporter, she asked, in voting against the measure. It also initially drew opposition from Representative Alexander Kolodin. But the Scottsdale Republican, now running for Secretary of State, later changed his mind after saying he had developed a new appreciation for Bowles, even if it came with a slap at other reporters. Don Bowles, as opposed to the current hacks that we have in the liberal media, was actually a newsman, Kolodin said. Bowles' assassination, unusual in the United States, provoked an immediate and unique response within the journalism community. Nearly 40 reporters from newspapers around the country, sponsored by Investigative Reporters and Editors Incorporated, launched an extensive probe that resulted in a series of stories about organized crime in Arizona. The series was printed in the Arizona Daily Star and many newspapers around the country, though not by the Arizona Republic, where Bowles had worked. Memorials at West Boland Plaza have not been without their controversy. In 2011, the state voted to tear down part of a memorial to the victims of the 2001 terrorist attack at the World Trade Center after some lawmakers said they were upset by some of the phrases carved into the ring. Then Senator L. Melvin, Republican of Tucson, said the memorial should have only patriotic, pro-American words and not phrases that represented attitudes at the time, like fear of foreigners. And in 2020, a monument to Confederate troops was removed from the park at the request of the United States Daughters of the Confederacy, the group that had placed it there in 1961 during increased activity in the civil rights movement. The group stated that the monument was in need of repair, but there was also something else with demonstrations and it being vandalized since the killing of George Floyd in Minneapolis. The organization said it would be unwise to repair it where it's located due to the current political climate. It has never been replaced. Among other memorials and monuments still in place are those honoring Purple Heart recipients, crime victims, canine that have worked with law enforcement, former Governor Ernest McFarland, and the 19 members of the Granite Mountain Hotshot crew killed during a 2013 fire. The next item is titled Times Square to Feature Patriotic Crystal Ball. This article was written by Susan Ney of the Associated Press. After the crystal ball drops on New Year's Eve in New York City, it will rise again, sparkling in red, white, and blue to usher in 2026 and kick off months of celebrations for the nation's upcoming 250th birthday. The patriotic touches at this year's Times Square gathering, including a second confetti drop, will offer an early glimpse of what's ahead. Hundreds of events and programs, big and small, planned nationwide to mark the signing of the Declaration of Independence in 1776. I'm telling you right now, whatever you're imagining, it's going to be much more than that, said America's 250 chair, Rosie Rios, who oversees the bipartisan committee created by Congress in 2016 to organize the quincentennial anniversary. It's going to be one for the ages and most inspirational celebration this country and maybe the world has ever seen. Rios and her group worked with the Times Square Alliance Business District and One Times Square, the building from where the ball is dropped, to make changes to this year's ceremonies. They're also planning a second ball drop event on July 3rd, on the eve of the nation's birthday, in the same beautiful style that Times Square knows how to do it, Rios said. It will mark the first time in 120 years that there will be a ball drop in Times Square that doesn't occur on New Year's Eve, she said. The New Year's Eve ball was first dropped in Times Square in 1907, built by a young immigrant metalworker named Jacob Starr. The 700-pound, 5-foot diameter ball was made of iron and wood and featured a 125-watt light bulbs. Last year, the Constellation Ball, the ninth and largest version, was unveiled. It measured about 12 feet in diameter and weighs almost 12,000 pounds. The only years when no ball drop occurred were in 1942 and 1943, when the city instituted a nightly dimeout during World War II to protect itself from attacks. Crowds instead celebrated the new year with a moment of silence, followed by chimes rung from the base of One Times Square. This year, the stroke of midnight will also mark the official launch of America Gives, a national service initiative created by America 250. Organizers hope to make 2026 the largest year of volunteer hours ever aggregated in the country. On the following day, America 250 will participate in the New Year's Day Rose Parade in Pasadena, California, with a float themed Soaring Onward Together for 250 years. It will feature three larger-than-life bald eagles representing the country's past, present, and future. Rios said she sees the wide range of celebrations and programs planned for the coming months, from large fireworks display and statewide potluck suppers to student contests and citizens' oral histories, as an opportunity to unite a politically divided nation. If we can find something for everyone, having those menus of options that people can pick and choose how they want to participate, she said. That's how we're going to get engaging 350 million Americans. Our next front page article is titled, Osiris Survives for New Role. This article was written by Henry Breen of the Arizona Daily Star. Her baby couldn't make it home for the holidays, but at least Dana Mendoza de la Agustina had some out-of-this-world snapshots to keep herself warm. De la Agustina is principal investigator for NASA's OSIRIS APEX spacecraft, which is currently cruising through the inner solar system en route to a rendezvous with the asteroid Apophis in 2029. This year was a busy one for the robotic space probe. In May alone, it survived its third close encounter with the sun and the temporary cancellation of its funding by the Trump administration. Then, in late September, with its budget partially restored, the spacecraft used its University of Arizona design cameras to collect pictures of Earth, including a couple of selfies, as it swung by at a distance of about 2,100 miles. De la Agustina's favorite is the photo NASA highlighted on its blog last month. I hand chose that one, she said. The assistant professor of the UFA's Lunar and Planetary Laboratory. It's Earth as a blue marble filling the field of view of our MapCam imager. The composite image showing Australia framed by swirling clouds over the southern hemisphere was taken from a distance of about 142,000 miles as a spacecraft accelerated away from its home planet once again. OSIRIS APEX is mercifully short for origins, spectral interpretation, resource identification, and security Apophis Explorer. It is a $200 million extension of NASA's earlier OSIRIS-REx mission, also led by U of A researchers that made history by briefly touching down on the asteroid Bennu in 2020 and returning samples from the space rock to Earth in 2023. Since then, the spacecraft, the size of a passenger van, has been circling the sun in a pursuit of its next target under the guidance of a mission team that includes the UFA, NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center, Lockheed Martin Space, KinetX Aerospace, and the Canadian Space Agency. The flyby of Earth on September 23 was the first of three slingshot maneuvers planned over the next 3 years. What our very clever flight dynamics engineers did is they found a way to use excessive Earth gravity assists to get a little more energy and then a little bit more energy, De La Agustina said. Those speed boosts will allow OSIRIS APEX to finally catch up with Apophis about 2 months after the asteroid as big as the Empire State Building streaks past our planet on April 13, 2029, close enough to be visible at night over parts of Europe and northern Africa. The spacecraft will then enter orbit around Apophis to collect high-resolution images and spectral data, before swooping in close enough to stir the surface of the asteroids with its thrusters. De la Agustina said they might even try jabbing the rock with the probe sampling arm. But first, she said, the mission must sweat through three more close perihelion passages where we get within the orbit of Venus, roughly 25 million miles closer to the sun than the spacecraft was originally designed to operate. We need to configure the spacecraft in just the right way to withstand that really warm environment, and then we need to deconfigure the spacecraft after we get out of those, De La Agustina explained. Engineers call it the fig leaf because it involves folding one of the two solar panel wings in such a way that it shields the probe's most sensitive bits. NASA's recent selfies from OSIRIS APEX were taken showing, or rather using, StoCam, the aptly named camera originally used to visually verify safe storage of asteroid samples collected during the probe's primary mission. One Stocam shot shows our pale blue planet rotating beneath the spacecraft's instrumental deck. Another is a double exposure taken from further away with a pea-sized moon on one side and a dime-sized Earth on the other. It's not just about collecting cool pictures, Dellagostino said. Passing close to Earth gives the science team something to train their instruments on in preparation for Apophis, allowing for crucial calibration that should improve the quality of the data they collect once the probe reaches its final destination. It's great when something fills our field of view, like the moon or a cloud on Earth, she said. Honestly, the moon is an amazing calibration target because, unlike our Earth with the dynamic atmosphere, the moon is what it is. Its color, its brightness, its spectral properties aren't really changing. One thing Dellagostino notices right away when she looks at the recent picture of Earth is how much better they look than the ones on the spacecraft captured in 2017, back when it was still known as OSIRIS-REx. I see the manifestations of a decade of using these instruments and really getting good at it. It represents just a huge amount of knowledge gained through years and years of practice, she said. That's part of the reason why these extended missions are such a good bargain. You go into them in some ways more capable than you started for the prime mission. As recently as May 30th, it looked like OSIRIS-APEX might be dead in space. But that's when the White House Office of Management and Budget announced plans to cancel 19 other active space missions, including the journey to Apophis, as part of a roughly 50% cut to NASA's science budget. Dellagostino called it the least fun I've ever had at my job, hands down. The news hit shortly after classes got out at the U of A, so instead of science, Dellagostino spent her summer break on a political advocacy, namely working with the university to communicate the importance of the ongoing mission to lawmakers on Capitol Hill, she said. Luckily, they had a compelling case to make. The planetary defense implications alone seemed like enough to save OSIRIS-APEX. If you want to be able to protect Earth from a killer asteroid like Apophis someday, you have to understand its composition and behavior. You can't just learn about how these things respond to impulsive forces without going and poking them, so to speak, Dellagostino said. It took several months and some key help from Republican Representative Juan Ciscomani and Democratic Senator Mark Kelly, but the mission's funding was eventually restored, at least in part. The thing that I think really hit home for people on both sides of the aisle is that this sort of thing, an asteroid this large getting so close to the Earth, only happens once every 7,500 years. And we have a billion-dollar asset that is already in space on its way to study that very, very rare event we are never going to get another opportunity to observe, Dellagostino said. It seemed like we were able to convince people that this is worthwhile science to be done. She said the experience was a valuable reminder of the importance of communication for scientists like her. If they want taxpayers to continue footing the bill for their research, they have to be able to articulate why that work matters. This is part of my job, Dellagostino said. I knew that before, but I really, really feel it in my bones now. The OSIRIS-APEX team is expecting a lot less excitement in the new year. If everything goes according to plan, 2026 should be the quietest part of the mission's so-called cruise period, leading up to its arrival at Apophis. Outside of the few maneuvers to maintain the proper heading, the spacecraft will spend the next year traversing empty space with no dramatic flybys of the Sun or the Earth until 2027. But the word cruise is a little misleading, Dellagostino said, because it gives the impression that we're just chilling. Even during downtimes, there's still plenty of work to be done. We found issues in our flight software from time to time that we need to correct, she said. Those changes have to be computed, written, uploaded to the spacecraft, and then tested. The team is also busy writing code to calibrate the scientific instruments in response to the tests conducted during the Earth flyby a few months ago. Mission scientists will need to figure out how to compensate for onboard sensors and camera lenses that might have gotten dirty during the probe's contact with Bennu 5 years ago. A coat of dust could actually turn out to be a good thing, Della Quistita said. She compared it to putting on sunglasses to keep from being blinded by Apophis, which is thought to be almost 10 times brighter than Bennu. There is a filter in optics called a natural density filter, and the dust kind of provides the same effect, she said. I mean, you can't make this stuff up, right? The mission recently picked up some extra science work and a little bit more money to pay for it. From NASA's Astrophysics Division, OSIRIS-REx, or rather OSIRIS-APEX, is now collecting data about what the Earth looks like from a distance to help in the search for life elsewhere in the galaxy. As researchers develop future missions to directly observe exoplanets beyond our own solar system, Della Quistita said they will need to know how to resolve those faraway worlds in different geometries based on where the objects are, and now they are being lit by their host stars. We have an opportunity to start observing the Earth in some of the unique geometries that you don't get unless you send an aircraft pretty far from our own planet, she said. We're giving them a good data set of what a habitable world looks like when you observe it under comparable conditions. A handful of earlier spacecraft have already sent back images of the distant Earth, perhaps none more famous than astronomer Carl Sagan's pale blue dot photo captured in 1990 by Voyager 1 from more than 3.7 billion miles away. But Della Quistita said OSIRIS-APEX is taking things to a whole new level because we're transiting the inner solar system a few times, and we are doing this very thoughtfully and not necessarily serendipitously. We can really examine the Earth under a wide variety of astronomical viewing conditions as well as a different wavelength. We can look in for those key spectral indicators of life, she said. The mission team began collecting the data in August as the spacecraft raced towards its first gravity assist in September. More observations will be made during the future flybys, starting with the next one in 2027. It's hard to get that something into space with these fantastic instruments, so it's great to maximize its use and learn as much as possible, Della Quistita said. OSIRIS-APEX's recent images of Earth are the perfect example of that, something gained by continuing to explore. It feels a little triumphant to see those pictures, she said. Beautiful data acquired through lots of lessons learned, and we're still kicking. Now we'll pause to remind you that you are listening to a broadcast reading of the Arizona Daily Star from Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Michael Shannon, and I'm a volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. If you miss any part of this program, you can access it on demand anytime on our website, www.sunsounds.org, from the broadcast info and audio link. Sun Sounds is also available on your smart home device. Now we'll turn the page to the Tucson and Region section of the Arizona Daily Star for several important and informative articles there. The next article is titled Restaurants Bracing for Wage Hike. This article was written by Annie Tacey of the Arizona Sonoran News. Tucson restaurant owners are bracing for a new minimum wage of $15.45 per hour, set to take effect January 1, 2026. The increase is mandated by the Tucson Minimum Wage Act, approved by city voters in November 2021, which sets the 2026 minimum at $15.45, 30 cents higher than the state minimum. Restaurant owners say this puts pressure on hospitality operators already contending with tight margins, rising food costs, and staffing challenges. Steve Chukri, president of the Arizona Association warn that even a modest increase to labor expenses can erode profitability. Restaurants already operate at razor-thin margins, he said. It's an added cost, and that doesn't necessarily mean you can raise menu prices to offset it. He noted that independent restaurants, which make up roughly 65% of Arizona's food establishments, are especially vulnerable. Without a large network to spread costs, these smaller operators must closely manage their spending. Even a 30 or 40 cent hike adds up when you consider how many people you employ and how many hours they work, Chukri said. Chukri added that many restaurants are increasingly relying on technology to absorb rising labor costs. We're seeing more restaurants lean into technology, robotic arms in the kitchen, ordering kiosks instead of cashiers to survive, he said. When labor costs and the cost of goods both rise, it takes a major hit out of an already fragile margin, he said. A 1 or 2 point shift can push restaurants from barely profitable to losing money very quickly. On a good day, he added, many restaurants run only 3 to 5% profit. Grant Kruger, owner of Union Public House, Reforma Modern, Mexican Mezcal and Tequila, and Proof Artisanal Pizza and Pasta, said, the rise in inflation over the past several years has made it harder to absorb these dual pressures. Minimum wages increases plus inflation over the last few years have caused an unprecedented rise in both labor and food costs, he said, adding that in turn forces menu adjustments that risk alienating customers. When prices go up, it hurts guest satisfaction. Nobody wants to pay more. To balance this, Kruger and his company leans heavily into technology, its cloud-based scheduling system that serves swap shifts, and staffing can flex based on predicted demand. Platforms like Restaurant 365 accounting software that tracks workforce and payroll and food costs weekly allow restaurants to respond faster to price swings. Kruger also criticized Arizona's $3 tip credit law that has remained unchanged since 2016. The law requires restaurants to pay servers the difference if their tip income does not equal the full minimum wage. Ray Flores, president of Flores Concepts El Charro Cafe, Charro Steak, and Del Rey, the Monica Charro Chico, said the cost realities go deeper than wages. Food costs rise and fall, but much of it is driven by market behavior, he said, citing high egg prices during bird flu scares and the rising cost of chicken wings during football and basketball season as market reactions, not policy-driven spikes. Independent restaurants don't have the contracts or bulk purchasing power to soften those swings, he said. Rather than immediately raising prices, Flores said his group is rethinking labor strategy, including reducing employee hours, selectively trimming operations, and investing more in training and tip management software. One big change is we don't hire as many teens for summer jobs anymore. Training someone for a few weeks is not cost-effective. Flores also pointed to structural labor challenges. Some employees want extra hours and volunteer to pick up shifts at our restaurants, but if they do, overtime rules force us to pay more than we budgeted, Flores said. Flores emphasized the importance of independent restaurants to the fabric of Tucson. If only big chains can survive, you end up with drive-thrus at every corner and fewer shared meals, he said. That hurts the local economy and building community identity. The next item is titled Goodwill Shooting Photos Released. This article was written by the Arizona Daily Star. Additional photos have been released of a man deemed a person of interest in a Tucson shooting that left 2 people in critical condition, authorities said. Meanwhile, a Tucson family has gone to social media to identify one of the people who was shot Friday morning at a Goodwill donation center on the city's southeast side. The shooting happened about 9:30 a.m. at the center in the 7600 block of East Valencia Road near South Los Reales Road, the Pima County Sheriff's Department has said. Both employees were taken to the hospital and were last said to be in critical condition. Neither has been identified by local authorities. In general, local law enforcement agencies only publicly release the names of crime victims who have died. But a GoFundMe account says that Juan Cristobal Flores is one of the people wounded in the shooting. It says Flores is a University of Arizona student and local opera singer who worked on the condition, who worked at the donation center part-time. Juan Cristobal has spent his life lifting others through music. Now he needs our voices, our prayers, and our help, the posting said. Flores was also a member of the choir at Catalina United Methodist Church. The church issued a statement on Facebook after the shooting. Catalina United Methodist Church is shocked and deeply saddened by the news of the recent shooting involving Juan Cristobal Flores, a beloved member of our faith community. Juan has been part of the Catalina UMC family for more than 10 years through a Scholar Singers program, which supports student musicians at the University of Arizona in their academic and vocational pursuits. During that time, he has been a vital and cherished member of our sanctuary choir, sharing his extraordinary voice, deep faith, and generous spirit with our congregation. Juan is known among us as kind, gentle, caring, and profoundly gifted. Investigators have released several images of a man wanted as a person of interest in the case, along with an image of a stolen Volvo. The vehicle is a white 2012 Volvo XC90 with Arizona license plate number C4A8Z4. Investigators say neither of the man nor car should be approached. The man is described as being about 6 feet tall, weighing about 200 pounds. Our next item is titled Pairs Polar Opposite Paths. This article was written by Laura Garsoni of the Arizona Republic. Two of Arizona's representatives in Congress are strikingly similar on paper. Both are the children of Middle East immigrants. At 33 and 34 years old, they're about a quarter century younger than most of their colleagues in the U.S. House. In total, there are three members of Congress who aren't religiously affiliated. They are two of them. Yet on Capitol Hill, they've become counterweights. One, Representative Yasemin Ansari, turned left, building her political brand as a no-nonsense millennial voice of progressive outrage. The other, Representative Abe Hamadeh, turned right, trafficking in election falsehoods to become a congressional foot soldier for President Donald Trump. Rising from true Arizona neighborhoods to the halls of Congress, the members of Congress took two different paths through American history. The child of immigrants from Iran, Ansari, a Democrat, grew up in Scottsdale and built a high-flying academic an early professional career that took her through Stanford, Cambridge, and the United Nations. Hamadeh, a Republican, is the son of an immigrant from Syria who was in the country illegally at the time Hamadeh was born. He grew up in the West Valley and said his family received food stamps. His career took him through Arizona's public university, the U.S. Army Reserve, and the Maricopa County's Attorney's Office, where he worked as a staff attorney. Since Ansari got to Capitol Hill, she has been in overdrive hammering the Trump administration and media in national media hits. Becoming the Democratic freshman class president for the U.S. House, getting special permission from House leaders to serve on extra committees, and building a social media brand that ranges from political commentary to praise of Taylor Swift. Hamadeh has kept a lower profile. He has appeared in media headlines primarily to defend or praise the powerful House Armed Services Committee and flaunted his loyalty to the president, decorating his office with gold trim to match Trump's Oval Office. The two politicians' diverging paths mirror the country's political divide. Wealthier voters have increasingly shifted towards the Democrats, and Republicans have a blown-out victory in 2024, framing liberals' ideals, internationalism, democratic norms, and cultural progressivism as hallmarks of an out-of-touch cultural economic elite. Republicans, meanwhile, have rode the wave of a populist revival sparked by Trump, slowly breaking the Democrats' working class and multiracial coalition. In the process, the party has generally rewarded political candidates who embrace the president's conspiracies and falsehoods. Ansari talked in depth about her background in a half-hour interview. "Abe seems to be a nice person," she told the Arizona Republic, "but the truth is I'm very much against his views of the world, especially the way he has refused to accept Republican election losses. I don't think that it's indicative of a serious person or a serious elected official," she said. Hamadeh, like Trump, generally is antagonistic towards the mainstream press and declined to sit for an interview. Asked several questions as he exited his office, Hamadeh said, "What makes you feel like you've earned that?" and accused the Arizona Republic of spreading fake news. Both Ansari, 33, and Hamadeh, 34, now occupy congressional seats that, barring an act of God or restricting redistricting, they can hold for as long as they wish. Both of the members of Congress come from families who sought to build a better life in the United States, but they met different fates along the way. Ansari's parents are Iranian immigrants who started a family on modest means in the Pacific Northwest and then relocated comfortably to Scottsdale. In an interview, Ansari said that in Iran, her father was more working class and her mother upper middle class, but both were educated. In the United States, her father worked as a civil engineer before putting himself through a nighttime MBA program, she said, eventually teaching himself how to invest money and building a successful wealth management firm. Her mother worked as a physical therapist. "That's why I'm so very, very compassionate towards refugees and immigrants and passionate about policies to improve their lives," she said. "Just knowing how hard they worked and how hard they sacrificed to try to start fresh. If I had been born in Iran instead of the United States, I would not be able to do any of the things that I wanted to do." Ansari said she inherited her work ethic. "I worked really hard, got very good grades in high school, and I was in charge of every club on campus," Ansari said. "I love to work." She inherited her wealth too. Her father regularly donates to the Democratic candidates and committees across the country, including his daughter, who in 2021 became the youngest woman ever to be elected to the Phoenix City Council, and in 2025 she became one of the youngest members of Congress. Ansari's father wrote her a six-figure loan to help her afford her condo in downtown Phoenix, valued between $500,000 and $1 million, which she later rented out. It was a piece of real estate that became a liability for her on a congressional debate stage. Her primary opponent, the longtime community organizer Raquel Tehran, who reported modest assets on a financial disclosure, described Ansari as a millionaire landlord. Both were running to represent one of the state's poorest congressional districts. The accusation elicited from Ansari is not particularly flattering campaign trail soundbite. "I don't consider myself a millionaire. On a financial disclosure, she reported assets totaling at least $2 million. In many ways, Hamadeh had a rockier path. His father is an immigrant from Syria who had overstayed a visa and was in this country illegally when Hamadeh was born, a circumstance that his party's leading commentators routinely and derogatorily referred to as being an anchor baby. His father also was accused of participating in the 1994 firebombing of a Chicago synagogue, but those charges were dropped in an episode of Hamadeh has described as an example of injustice as he witnessed in the legal system. Hamadeh has said in interviews that his family was on food stamps at one point in my life. He attended public schools in the West Valley. The family became upwardly mobile in time. While Hamadeh was beginning his unsuccessful campaign for Arizona Attorney General, his older brother had established himself as a broker and investor in Phoenix's booming real estate market. He donated six-figure sums in support of his younger brother's campaign for Attorney General and later for Congress. Between his two campaigns, Hamadeh reportedly earned an income doing consulting, much of it through an LLC he owns. Last year, he loaned his campaign about $400,000, bringing the sum of his reported debt somewhere between $500,000 and $1 million. That's about the same amount as his reported assets. Now, having won a safe GOP seat, he is well-positioned as one of Arizona's up-and-coming Republicans. Unlike Ansari, Hamadeh doesn't show much sentimentality towards immigrants. He has remained in lockstep with Trump, even as the president has championed reforms, which, if implemented, would have foreclosed Hamadeh's own citizenship, life in the United States, and his political career. Priorities such as ending birthright citizenship, deporting people who are in this country illegally, and during Trump's first term, significantly limiting immigration from Syria and other Middle East countries. The Democrats said there was no border invasion when hundreds of thousands of illegal immigrants were crossing, Hamadeh wrote on a social media in August. President Trump fixed our border in 2 weeks. Of the 535 people sworn into Congress this January, only three identify as religiously unaffiliated, according to Pew Research. Ansari and Hamadeh are two of them. In Ansari's case, that's because, like many in the Iranian-American diaspora, she and her family have a deeply rooted belief in secular governance. It's something she frequently mentions when making her case against Trump's second-term agenda. The political arm of the Freedom From Religious Foundation named Ansari the secularist of the week in October after she helped introduce a resolution defending the separation of church and state. My parents fled a theocratic authoritarian regime. They suffered under the state that was ruled by religion instead of by the people, Ansari said in a written statement. The First Amendment and long-standing practice guarantees these rights, which are under attack by the Trump administration's extreme right-wing and Christian nationalist agenda. Ansari, a self-described agnostic, took her oath of office on the Constitution, as did former Senator Kyrsten Sinema before her. Hamadeh, the son of a Muslim father and Druze mother, cast himself differently. It wasn't so long ago that his 2024 congressional primary opponent plastered the district with photos of Hamadeh in Mecca, draped in Muslim ritual clothing, captioned, America was founded on Islamic principles. A decontextualized quote from his teenage years debating politics in an online forum. Hamadeh and his allies called the attacks bigoted and racist. Through a spokesperson, the campaign assured the district's majority white Republican primary electorate that he believes in Jesus and Judeo-Christian values. At his swearing-in in the following years, he took his oath of office on a Bible. As the 2025 holiday season approached, his team celebrated on social media the Christmas tree he stood up in his office, which he installed before Thanksgiving. He described his religious affiliation to Pew as non-denominational and not in a particular faith. Atheism is a political liability for U.S. politicians, a 2020 Gallup survey found, polling worse with the general public than any other religious or categorization. Though Hamadeh is now one of the party's rising stars, his political victories have often been ambiguous. Like many Republican voters, he is the product of the domestic economy he promotes with America First flair. Hamadeh went to Arizona State University, where he studied political science and went on to receive a law degree from the University of Arizona. Later, he enlisted in the United States Army Reserve, completing a 14-month deployment in Saudi Arabia. Those who knew him at the time recall a cheerful fiscal conservative involved with the Arizona Chamber of Commerce and Industry, who was politically genial enough to regularly lunch with friends across the political spectrum. This prior iteration of Hamadeh can still be seen on his social media. It was a time when he wrote said conservatively rather than in Trump-style capital letters and penned chipper, libertarian-inflected tweets. "This is actually a pretty good idea. Immigrants are hard workers," he wrote, praising a plan by Senator Rand Paul, Republican of Kentucky, to invite immigrants to live in a low-tax, deregulated economic freedom zone. It was good listening to Stuart Baker, former general counsel of the NSA, at the Arizona Chamber, but disagreed with him totally on anonymity, he wrote in June of 2013. He launched his campaign for the Attorney General in late 2021 and soon began echoing Trump's stolen election claims, which galvanized the American right even as they destabilized the country's foundational democratic norms. He secured the president's endorsement and won the Republican primary. Due to time constraints, we have reached the end of today's reading of the Arizona Daily Star, the December 29th, 2025 edition. For Sun Sounds of Arizona, this is Michael Shannon, your volunteer reader. Thank you very much for listening.